Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Yeah, and joining us today are The Times' very own James Gearbrand and Bill Edgar. Coming up, we'll look ahead to the weekend's Premier League action, which includes one of England's classic fixtures, as unbeaten Liverpool and Arsenal go head-to-head at Anfield. But first to the fallout, which marred Manchester United's 1-1 draw at Wolves on Monday night, as Paul Pogba was racially abused online following his missed penalty at Molineux. Well, Pogba's Manchester United teammates, Harry Maguire and Marcus Rashford, have come out in support of him following the incident, calling on social media companies to stop racist messages being published. Maguire tweeted it was disgusting, that social media need to do something about it. Every account that is open should be verified by a passport or driving license. He said, stop these pathetic trolls making numerous accounts to abuse people. And Marcus Rashford added on his own account, enough now, this needs to stop. Manchester United is a family. Paul Pogba is a huge part of that family. You attack him, you attack us all at Manchester United. Now, Pogba is the third player in a week to be racially abused on social media following a penalty miss. That's after Tammy Abraham's missed spot kick in the Super Cup against Liverpool. And then there was Yacoub Mété, the Reading striker, who was also abused for his missed penalty in a game against Cardiff. Phil Neville, the England women's head coach, has been asked questions about social media. He suggested that clubs and footballers should boycott social media over the racist abuse. And I know we'd all agree that social media companies need to do more, but should players themselves be boycotting social media? Where do we stand on that?
The big question. I mean, firstly, it's perhaps a bit depressing seeing what Rashford said, that if you attack Pogba, you attack us all at Manchester United. So appealing to Manchester United fans, thinking, well, I won't send out a racist message because it might affect Manchester United. You know, that's the kind of level you have to deal with, and it may well be right. But it's a very deep question. I mean, I guess all you can say is, football, because it's so high profile, if footballers make a stand or football community make a stand, at least it gets masses of publicity. It's right around the country, so at least the message gets across. I mean, people have said, isn't it a bit unfair that there'll be so much focus on protecting the handful of black players at the top of the British game, when what about everybody else who's getting racist abuse around the country? Obviously, I mean, that is unfair. However, you know, at least by highlighting the issue that the footballers are facing, then it does bring it out into the open, and perhaps that's the best you can do.
The PFA obviously had a boycott at the end of last season. That was for 24 hours. And
that was the Twitter blackout, wasn't
it? Yeah, when they posted the same message on a bright red background. And it was widely shared, and I think it probably could have been deemed a success. But I think getting footballers to stay off social media for 24 hours is a task in itself. So the idea that it should be any longer than that, or the fact that they should have to, is really A, unrealistic, and B, it's nonsense. It shouldn't have to happen. I think generally it's unrealistic too for so many reasons. I think Alison Rudd wrote about this yesterday in the paper, that social media is something that clubs use for commercial reasons now, and there's a lot of positive interaction between supporters of clubs and their club and its players. So the idea that should have to have to end, or that's necessary to make a message strong enough that this is unacceptable. I don't think there's any justification for that, personally.
I think obviously there are kind of two issues, aren't there? I think there certainly is some fault on the part of the social media companies themselves, because they're very, in general, they're very kind of slow and lax in banning these accounts and in taking strong action on racist abuse and in fact, you know, depressingly, you know, quite a few of our ethnic minority or black journalist colleagues report that, you know, in instances where they've had racist epithets directed at them, quite often they'll report it and the account, no action will be taken. And I honestly don't know why that is. I mean, it's absolutely baffling to me that, you know, an account can abuse someone with a racist term and it comes back and their Twitter finds no violation. I genuinely don't get that. And I'd sort of like to understand it. That just seems so obviously wrong to me, and I'd sort of like to understand how that can possibly be justified. Obviously, there's also a much more broad issue in that kind of Twitter is only kind of the conduit. It's only sort of a reflection of society. You know, it's ultimately, it's not Twitter's fault that, you know, that the original kind of wrong is obviously people kind of seeing fit to abuse people in this way anyway. And I think the mentality of it is so depressing, because as you alluded to, in this particular week, all the instances followed an instance of a player in a vertical was doing something wrong, i.e. missing a penalty. But I think there's that whole kind of attitude of, you know, sort of accountability, you know, if a player does something wrong or, you know, makes a sort of mistake that obviously they have no intention of making in a match. Footballers will make mistakes. It's the nature of any sport. And I think the idea that footballers are kind of accountable to the fans for anything that they do wrong on the pitch is such a kind of deep-rooted one, and such a kind of hard one to unravel. And my personal view is that players, I feel there's a real kind of, there's been a sort of rash in recent seasons of players apologising to fans for bad performances or apologising to fans for doing things wrong. And I just don't agree with that. I don't think any player, you know, I think it's a bad precedent to set, because it creates the idea that players are accountable for things that, you know, are just simply the nature of the game. But I mean, how you kind of, you know, go about stopping people going online to send racist abuse to people, I mean, that's huge societal
issue. Yeah, it's not football. It's not football's issue.
That's an intractable.
It's a huge, huge issue.
Problem.
I don't think you can have this conversation without sort of acknowledging the sort of political climate throughout the country and Europe and beyond, and it just seems to be becoming more commonplace that this is, and sort of the idea that it's becoming slightly more I don't know, it seems to be more acceptable, or like, and even our political leaders. So I know this is a football podcast, but really I think it's all intertwined, and there's no doubt that this is not football's issue alone.
Definitely not. On the game then itself at Wolves, the big talking point was the decision for Paul Pogba, then not Marcus Rashford, to take the penalty that Pogba eventually missed. Rashford had scored a penalty in the opening game against Chelsea, whilst Pogba, well, has a poor record from the spot, missing 4 of his 11 Premier League spot kicks. Now, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer defended the decision, claiming the club share penalties between Rashford and Pogba, depending on who fancies it on the day. Do we believe this? Gregor, come on, you've played, you know how it works. Is that how it happens, that it's down to the players to decide?
I was trying to think this on the way in. Have I played in a team where there wasn't necessarily a designated penalty kick taken? And undoubtedly I have, yeah. I don't think...
When is there a designated corner taker for each side, a designated thrower on a free kick taker? Are they not all planned beforehand, usually?
Well, yeah, and increasingly... So I think the game is changing, obviously, and it has changed since I played. And what Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville were saying on Sky Sports about the sort of the great detail and preparation and analysis, and every there's no stone left unturned. The goalkeepers study the history, the history of penalty kick takers, where they've hit the shots and stuff. So the idea that it's been left to a conversation on the pitch, that's the only thing about this. You can have more than one penalty kick taker, but that having a conversation about who's taking it on the pitch, A, increases the pressure on the whoever does take the kick eventually, and B, it just doesn't look good. And I think it's just sort of brought pressure on himself sort of unnecessarily, really.
But I mean, surely if you have more than one penalty kick taker, you're very liable to end up in that situation where it's not entirely clear, and you do have to have a conversation on the pitch.
I think it would be wise to know who it is before the game. The idea that this was, the idea behind it is you only know when the penalty kick is awarded if you have the confidence to take it or whether you feel right. That's nonsense. If any of us think that Paul Pogba or Marcus Rashford are not going to be confident enough to take a penalty kick, I think confidence is not a thing either of those two players lack necessarily. And if they do, if they really don't have the confidence in that moment, they can still give it to someone else. But the idea that that's the reason behind it, I'm not really having. I also understand that he's trying to give some responsibility to players, perhaps. You know, I mean, football now just seems like players are cogs in a increasingly complicated system, and then they don't have much responsibility for anything. So I understand that, you know, give players some responsibility now on the pitch, but not in that instance, no.
I would defend Pogba a bit in terms of his record. I mean, 4 out of 11 does sound bad, but that's, so he scored 7 out of 11 for Manchester United, all of which are since the start of last season in the Premier League. He scored his only penalty in the Champions League, so that's 8 out of 12. On the normal conversion rate in football, you'd expect to score either 9 or 10, so he's not that far off. And the four he's missed, he's struck reasonably well. I think against Wolves and Southampton, he struck it reasonably well. Not quite so good against Everton, Burnley, but he did score from the follow-up against Everton. So, so I wouldn't say he's a complete, you know, give up on him.
I like
completely.
That. You've turned a negative into a positive.
Yeah, I wouldn't. On the other hand, Rashford has done very well so far. So, if you were choosing, I guess you'd go with Rashford at the moment.
Well, it has, as a result of that game, being suggested that Solskjaer has now taken Pogba off penalty duties. Some of the European transfer windows, we know, don't close for a few more weeks, but with it looking unlikely that anyone is willing to pay the big fee for Pogba, how big a risk is it to have potentially an unhappy player in the squad if, for example, Solskjaer has taken one of his duties away from him? And he is a big character, as we know.
He certainly is, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it seems a risk just in that fact alone that he's potentially going to be unhappy, but he's not seemed very happy for a while, and he still sees flashes of what he's capable of. Whether he's capable of it on a consistent regular basis, even if he is happy or not, is another question. I'm not entirely convinced that he is. He just seems to be someone who can be brilliant and then sort of fairly average in the grand scheme of things for what he's capable of. So I suppose it is a bit of a risk, but at the same time, Manchester United really need him. I don't see, there's not much depth in that squad at the moment. They'll let players go and there could be more to go, but if he's one of them, then, you know, their midfield looks really, really weak.
There's very little. There's McTominay and Pogba playing, and there's Fred could come back, but he's done almost nothing at Manchester United, so absolutely they have to stick with Pogba. You could imagine him really losing, almost giving up in the Mourinho era, when Mourinho was publicly criticising him, obviously, you know, shouting at him in training and things like that, which was caught on video. But, I mean, Solskjaer's not saying any of that, at least in public anyway. So I don't think it's, in any case, you'd stick with Pogba, I think.
Staying with United, Romelu Lukaku, who's now at Inter Milan, has spoken about his final year at Old Trafford. He says he, alongside Pogba and Alexis Sanchez, were made scapegoats for what went wrong in a somewhat disappointing campaign last season. James, is he right, or did those three players simply not perform?
Manchester United, for the past sort of three seasons, have been fundamentally quite mediocre, perhaps would be harsh, but they've performed roughly around a sort of certain level, which is sort of, you know, kind of the fifth or sixth best team in the league, apart from the period shortly after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was appointed, when for probably about two or three months they played really consistently good football. They've played in the past three or four seasons the best period they've had. Obviously things went a little bit, results deteriorated towards the end of last season, but I think during that period when they were really good, I thought Pogba was absolutely central to that, and sort of really began to look like one of the form midfielders in Europe. So influential was he during that period. I actually felt Lukaku was, although not an automatic player during that period, actually produced some pretty good performances. Often starting on the wing, Solskjaer used him on out wide, and I actually thought he was quite good. Particularly in the case of Pogba, I think there's always been a slight tendency to sort of scapegoat him. And
I think Pogba, yeah, definitely picked out as a scapegoat. Definitely too much. Lukaku's there. I mean, Pogba, Lukaku, and Sanchez are the three kind of really big buys, and money they've thrown a huge transfer fee or wages at, and Pogba's been okay, but below what he should have been. Lukaku's okay. Sanchez, obviously, well below par. But I mean, you have to, I'd say, two excuses for him. One, the constant injuries, which have really dragged him down. And secondly, the style of play under Mourinho. It was so dull and so negative. So in contrast to what he's been used to at Arsenal and Barcelona and with Chile, that I think it was just really hard to fit in. Normally he gets the ball up near the penalty area and you've got three or four options, and under Mourinho there was one option if he was lucky, you know. So it was, I think it's very hard for him to fit in, but so even allowing for that, he was poor. But yeah, I guess they were the three names we picked out just because they were the big money names, and it's easier to have a go at them than, say, Lingard, Rashford and McTominay, who all came through the ranks.
Yeah. I think Sanchez is a different question. He's a man unto himself. He's done nothing, really, since he's been there. And there might be reasons, personal reasons, who knows, but it's just been an absolute disaster, that move. Lukaku, I think sometimes the rhetoric around his sort of abilities and performance is sort of really bemusing, you know, making it like this guy who scored nearly a goal every two games for every club except Chelsea is hopeless. You know, he's far from hopeless, and he's had many millions of pounds lavished on him as well. And he scored 15 goals last season in all competitions, and that was supposed to be a hopeless season. It was a difficult season for him, but he still scored 15 goals. And Pogba scored 16 and got 11 assists. And there were still conversations about him. And I think some of them were justified. As I said, I think he is someone who he just doesn't produce the levels he's capable of on a consistent enough basis like the best players do. That's often the difference between the best players and the rest.
Do you think within the framework of this United team, do you think, for example, Kevin De Bruyne would be performing better than Paul Pogba has done over the past two seasons?
Yes. I don't think... I take your point, absolutely, that he's been playing in very difficult circumstances, and a manager who, and Mourinho particularly, was throwing him under a bus regularly. It's just not been a happy place, and I take your point, but I think, yes, I think De Bruyne would have had far more influence on the team generally. I don't know. Do you disagree with that?
I do think a lot of it is just, you know, the framework that a player is playing within, and this, you know, Manchester United side is, as I mentioned, has been intermittently very good, but sort of fundamentally hasn't performed. It's the team just isn't at the same level as the likes of, in an attacking sense particularly, as the likes of Manchester City and Liverpool. And as you alluded to, his returns in terms of goals and assists are still very, very good. And I wonder,
What if you swapped that around and you put Pogba in the Manchester City team? Would he have the same effect as someone like De Bruyne or any of those midfielders?
I think he might well do. I mean, if you look at Manchester City's record over the last 2 years, almost every player they brought in is absolutely sensational. I mean, it's Zinchenko, a kind of a, you know, on the face of it, an average young Ukrainian midfielder. Stick him in at left back, he's absolutely a title winning standard. And it was Manchester United, most of their purchases have just been very average. I mean, we really to deduce that United's recruitment has been hopeless across the board and Manchester City's have been brilliant across the board. I mean, I think it's so much to do with Man City having such an incredible manager and creating a template of a tactical template, which pretty much everybody could fit into.
Let's talk about perhaps the standout fixture of the weekend, with Liverpool taking on Arsenal. And James, you wrote an interesting piece in the Times this week about Arsenal's owners starting to show that they care. I think earlier on in the summer, everyone was alluding to the fact that Arsenal didn't have a lot of money to spend. And I know they've been quite clever with their transfer strategy, but they have spent over 130 million. Tell us a little bit more about your article.
It's essentially Arsenal, I think, were quite clever in the way they did their business in the summer, as it was sort of widely kind of reported that their kind of the sort of total amount of money they had to spend, having missed out on Champions League football, was about 40 million plus outgoings. They've been a lot of clubs. They've been particularly clever in their use of sort of stage payments, effectively, which are not kind of just an Arsenal thing. A lot of clubs do this. But for example, the Nicolas Pepe and Saliba deals are kind of structured over, they're structured over five seasons. So that's, in a nutshell, how Arsenal have been able to seemingly spend so much money in a transfer window in which they were supposed to be relatively hard up.
Well, as you say then, the Arsenal director, Josh Kroenke, revealed after conceding the four goals in the second half of the Europa League final, they decided to change their recruitment strategy and approach this summer. And he has praised club staff for working their magic in the transfer market. Question is, can they really continue their bright start further into this season? Now, Jamie Carragher has already said that the Arsenal strikers of Aubameyang, Lacazette, and now adding Pepe into that forward line can really trouble a Liverpool side, especially, Bill, without their first-choice keeper.
Yeah, I guess that quote from Kroenke, I mean, if it's literally true, it's slightly alarming, and that if Chelsea just happened to have not had their shooting boots on in that match, does that mean they wouldn't have signed, Arsenal wouldn't have signed anyone, or just signed a couple of, made a couple of small signings, you know, the whole long-term planning would have changed.
Yeah, work the magic, maybe also, as James alluded to, I think it's maybe stretching it, and also a bit early to say.
Yes, it's definitely early to say. I mean, Pepe's, you know, only being introduced slowly, and Tierney's not started yet, and Saliba's gone out on loan. Obviously, Dani Ceballos, the new central midfielder, did really well. I think Alisson is a big miss for Liverpool. He was fantastic last season, and Adrian was very erratic at the end at West Ham, and he has been so in his brief time now at Liverpool. Obviously, his howler to gift the goal to Southampton last week to Danny Ings was pretty terrible, and then generally hasn't inspired much confidence. So that's quite a big drop off. However, Liverpool's defence in general is very strong, so it'd be asking quite a lot, say, for Aubameyang, Lacazette and Pepe all to suddenly intertwine like Salah, Mane and Firmino, you know, how they've developed over several years. You'd have to say Liverpool are a strong favourite, certainly for this game. It is a step in the right direction, I think, for Arsenal, making these, you know, decent looking signings.
Absolutely, I think that front three, given time, a bit of time together to kind of, as Bill's alluded to sort of get to know each other's play and also under Emery as well, they'll be a threat to anyone, I think. And right up there, Liverpool's front three are devastating, but they look really, really a lot of potential. And Reece Nelson also is not kind of set the world alight in the last two games, but he's been an important player for them, and I think this is a big season for him. And Ceballos has been, well, that first game was hugely encouraging. So yeah, I think the Liverpool, the issue with Arsenal is going to be defensively. Luiz is obviously been a big signing for them in terms of bringing some experience, but I think they're still going to be heavily tested at Anfield.
I'm really intrigued to see over the course of the season how that the Arsenal front three of Aubameyang, Pepe and Lacazette develops, because obviously in terms of individual quality. You know, it's a really exceptional looking front three. I think you could argue in terms of the quality of the players, it's sort of up there with, you know, the Liverpool front three or the Man City front three, or certainly not too far behind. But it's not a natural front three because obviously, you know, Aubameyang and Lacazette are really both centre forwards, although we have seen Aubameyang play sort of more on the wing. It's not his, you know, I don't think it's his best position, whereas Pepe is more of a kind of conventional sort of modern winger. So it'll be really interesting to see how Unai Emery kind of balances that, whether, for example, Pepe plays a bit wider and you know, maybe there's a slightly kind of unbalanced lineup with more width on one side coming from the fullback or the wing back. I'm intrigued to see how it settles. And also because one thing we know about Emery is that he's not someone in his first season in particular who seemed to necessarily prioritise having a sort of really settled and consistent system. He's someone who is a bit of a chameleon in terms of the formation and the systems that he played. So it'll be really intriguing, I think, to see how they develop under his management.
Mm. Aubameyang and Lacazette, obviously, we know plenty about. But, Bill, you mentioned Ceballos, and he was instrumental for Arsenal's victory against Burnley. So how much do you think Jurgen Klopp will be identifying him as someone that they'll have to stop?
Yeah, he's very creative. He's almost like a typical Arsenal player under Wenger, you know, sort of a very... not huge physically, but very creative midfielder. But he was playing as a kind of, you know, one of the central midfield three, so it wasn't kind of too advanced. So he did his defensive work well as well, including a very good interception and before which he set up Aubameyang for the winner. So yeah, it's definitely worth watching. I also thought Joe Willock played very well.
Yeah.
Against Burnley, you know, kind of almost out of nowhere. And I mean, he absolutely
real legs in midfield, which is you know, a bit different to Van Dijk in there.
Mm. Yes, I mean,
wonder how long they'll kind of.
Yeah, I don't know how long. I mean, exactly. Yeah, I guess Xhaka will, you know, they'll have him in as the first choice.
Well, he's the captain, though, isn't he?
Yes, I think they were.
I think that was something that was almost a bit of a.
Yeah.
People were sniggering about in the summer that.
Yeah.
Xhaka's been named the captain, and he's not always kind of.
No,
received flatteringly, and
yeah. No, he'll miss the odd game through suspension, of course.
Indeed, you know? Yeah.
I think Xhaka has his qualities both on the pitch and off the pitch. He's a much, much maligned player, but I think he's very good. He's a very good passer, and I think someone who looked better kind of alongside Torreira, sort of having a genuine sort of defensive midfielder alongside him. And speaking as sort of having followed Arsenal a little bit, sort of on their kind of, you know, and sort of done mix zones and stuff, Xhaka's a player who always fronts up, whatever his other kind of faults may be. He's someone who's very kind of, he's very good at taking responsibility, and, you know, he will always kind of, he'll always speak and front up.
I know, Bill, you mentioned how good their defence is, but they've changed the way they sort of are playing. They're playing a higher line at the moment, and it means they actually haven't kept a clean sheet at all this season. Why do you think Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp have done that?
Yeah, you know, the system worked perfectly last season. No particular reason to change anything. But yeah, they've definitely not been quite as impressive this season so far. I mean, Chelsea created loads in the Super Cup against them, and Norwich at Anfield were opened them up time and again. I know Liverpool deserved to win overall because they had loads of chances themselves, but I mean, and then in the first half last Saturday, I thought Southampton again were creating a lot against Liverpool. Maybe Liverpool just taking a bit of time to get into their stride. I wouldn't say it's a long-term problem yet. It's a bit too, you know, early in the season. But
it is odd, though. I mean, given it's the same personnel.
Yeah. As Bill said, has done so well, why would you change it?
And well, the thing is, when he's been asked, Klopp's been asked, or when the players have been asked, they say they've not changed anything, but it's their It's really our eyes aren't deceiving us. It's kind of the only thing some people have tried to suggest is that VAR is, he's sort of looked over the summer that maybe marginal calls are going to be.
So like the offsides is what he's trying to play.
They're
going to
be decided, yes. You know, it's going to be definitive. Although that's something else we've spoken about too much. So that's the only, you know, that's the only thing you could think of. But it does seem strange, and they don't look happy. You can tell that the players are sort of. Van Dijk seems to be shouting and bawling at people all the time, and there's much bigger holes appearing in their defence than we've been used to seeing. So. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see how long that continues.
Okay, there's been plenty of EFL action this week, with Leeds and Fulham the big winners, and Nathan Jones's Stoke the losers. Leeds have gone top after their victory over Brentford in midweek, but perhaps the standout result, not by the scoreline necessarily, even though it was a big scoreline with Fulham beating Millwall 4-0, Gregor, is the actual possession that Fulham had in that game.
Yeah, almost 85% possession. I think I read somewhere that was the most since Opta have been sort of registered in the Championship. So
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's incredible, really. I think there's quite a bit of excitement building about Fulham. I know it's early, but I'd say they have the best squad in the Championship. In fact, signed really well, Cavaliero from Wolves, Knockhart. Keeping Mitrovic was big. Bobby Reid is also waiting in the wings there. Harry Arter's, you know, these people who've played in the Premier League. Tom Kearney, keeping him as well. So certainly going forward, there's some proposition. So I think they've got the best squad in the Championship. Leeds have the best coach in the Championship, and Fulham have Scott Parker, who we know very little about, you know. We know of him, but this is his first full season in management. So I think Fulham's sort of season could hinge upon how he deals with the sort of rigors of a Championship campaign, and it's going to be fascinating to watch. They're definitely the two teams that are everyone's tipping for to battling out for the title. Really, Swansea have made a really surprising start for many people after losing Ollie McBurnie in the summer for $20 million to Sheffield United. He was really their only striker. They beat QPR at Loftus Road during the week, and obviously appointed Steve Cooper, who was former England under-17s coach, replaced Graham Potter in the summer. That was a really interesting appointment, and his start's been really encouraging. So they're the sort of front runners, and then down at the bottom we have Stoke City and Nathan Jones, and it seemed like the summer was going to be the time that the rot had kind of might have stopped, because it's been pretty deep set rot. It's kind of right since their final season in the Premier League under Mark Hughes and Paul Lambert, and then Gary Rowett coming in last year, and they're spending millions of pounds and really, really struggling. I think Nathan Jones, since he left Luton for the Potteries in January, he's won 3 games, and they were convincingly beaten by Preston. Jack Butland is having an absolute shocker at the moment, throwing in goals. And this is a guy.
2 goals last night.
This is a guy who was expecting to be in England squad until very recently, and I think Nathan Jones has said he's maybe going to have to take him out the firing line until they can find a win. So yeah, I think, and they face Leeds on Saturday. That's where I'm going, in fact. So I'm looking forward to that game, and it's not going to be an easy one for them to get some much needed points on the board.
Yeah.
Going back to Fulham, I think it's really interesting how, as if you remember, Fulham's promotion campaign 2 seasons ago was very much built on that, you know, extremely high possession passing style of football under Slavisa Jokanovic, and obviously since then there's been kind of, you know, enormous amount of upheaval with Jokanovic being sacked and obviously replaced by Ranieri, who in turn has been replaced by Scott Parker. Incredible kind of upheaval in the playing staff, huge number of signings in the ultimately failed Premier League campaign last season. I think it's really interesting how the squad has been able to sort of slip back into that style that they were so successful with in the Championship 2 seasons ago. And I can't believe that they're able to keep Mitrovic in the summer transfer window. That really surprised me, given the dearth of good young centre forward, like out and out young centre forwards in the top five leagues around Europe. You know, they were able to keep hold of a guy who, you know, I think he's 23, a guy who scored 10 goals in the Premier League last year at the age of 23. I thought was really surprising, but obviously huge.
24. He's 25 next month.
Nonetheless, I thought it was really surprising.
Approaching his prime.
Yeah, exactly. 29. Still, my point stands. No, I was surprised they were able to hold on to him, but fantastic for them. And as Gregor says, I do think, yeah, I agree with Gregor, the squad looks strong for this level.
But I just wanted to get your take on Jack Butland, in the sense that there has been suggestions that he could have been called up to the England squad. But obviously, his form of late is questionable, so perhaps wouldn't even be considered right now. But should Gareth Southgate be dipping into the Championship for players?
Yeah, certainly. If it doesn't matter where they're playing, you know, you look anywhere. But usually, particularly with goalkeepers, you think, well, you can look in the Championship because you're kind of linking with the rest of the team a bit less. I mean, if you're a brilliant player, but who's got great vision, but all your teammates don't share your vision, you know, your game can really suffer if you're at a much lower level, for example. But as a goalkeeper, it's, I know that there is a bit of teamwork, but it's much more an individual level. So, you know, you should be able to just be, if you're a good shot stopper, you're a good shot stopper wherever, you know. So it's surprising that he's fallen away like that. But yeah, if he was playing well, then certainly Southgate should look at him. But as we see, I mean, he's not heading for league, he's going to be heading for the bench in a team that's heading for League One. Stoke, it's interesting to see. It's worth fans of teams like Bournemouth and Watford, who have been quite comfortable in the Premier League over quite a few years, you know, it's worth bearing in mind, you know, appreciate what you've got while you're there, you know, because Stoke were year after year after year, you know, Pulis and Hughes, they kept them up comfortably mid-table. Then they suddenly dropped, kind of one half season under Hughes, and they dropped again, and then they got rid of him, and now it's all collapsed. But, you know, it's worth, you know, making the most of it, you know, appreciating what you've got while you're there. You know.
Well, talking of appreciating what you've got, there are some clubs who are in financial difficulty. As at the time of this recording, we still don't know what's going to happen with Bury. As for Bolton, things also seem to go from bad to worse for them. They've had games postponed. They have no players, no money, and now no manager after Phil Parkinson resigned, along with his assistant Steve Parkin. So, Gregor, what on earth is going to happen with Bolton? And in terms of a new boss, how can they go on? How can they recruit a new boss in this situation that they're in?
I can't see how they can until the purchase of the club is sorted, really. How can they appoint a new manager? Who's going to really? I saw someone saying on Twitter that works on that sort of Northwest beat that Rochdale, the former Rochdale manager Keith Hill, was interested. But I mean, you know, he's a good manager, but that's not really probably the guy, the sort of level of manager that Bolton would be expecting to go for if they're in a better state of health. So I don't think they'll do anything. I think that the youth team coach is going to take charge.
Jimmy Phillips.
He's going to take charge at the weekend, and then they just need the sale to go through so that they can buy players and not rely on 17-year-olds in their first team, and, you know, sign some players to help them at least make a fist of this season. But it looks increasingly like they're going to be in League Two next year, and it's making a mockery of League One because, you know, they refused to play against Doncaster during the week. Doncaster got had a free week, and when everyone else was playing, they're rested up. Well, how different are Bolton going to look in 6 months' time when other teams are playing them? It's just really the League One is an absolute mess this year, and obviously that's before we even speak about Bury, who come tomorrow may no longer be a member of it.
Yeah, you're right, and also it's almost going to be effectively two teams relegated from you know, if Bury and Bolton are obviously going down, even if Bury survive, well, either way, you know, and so it's just two out of 22 now, so it's changing. But as Gregor says, I mean, you know, if Bolton's youth team, or you know, barely their youth team, is playing against one team going for promotion, then by April, Bolton have had a takeover and they're quite strong again, and now they're playing another team going for promotion. I mean, it's horribly lopsided and unfair, isn't it?
Yeah, that level playing field will be certainly questioned, won't it? Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Bill Edgar and James Gearbrand.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
Yeah, it's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. Now, we'll be back on Monday looking back on all of the weekend's action, which includes that mouth-watering clash between Liverpool and Arsenal at Anfield.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.